There are some times when I will write a sermon title, and then the 3 weeks or 4 weeks or 5 weeks later, I look at it and go, what was I thinking? What's the topic? What was I really wanting to write? This is one of those cases where I absolutely knew at the time what I wanted to talk about, but I'm not sure how I came up with a sermon title other than it related to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and the idea of not to panic. And I was reminded of the synchronicity of life, as if life has a divine plan, when I opened the newspaper this morning and it said, don't panic. Hard to do. I mean, it really is hard not to panic. We have a lot of fear in our world. FDR said, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, which was probably the first meta statement of the 20th century. But essentially, it's not true. Fear is something that is completely normal and natural, and we're born with certain ingrained fears. Two that almost everyone agrees. Babies are born with a fear of falling and a fear of fire. And we learn lots of other fears after that. Some of them appropriate, many of them appropriate. And fear is not a bad thing. Without fear, nobody grows up. Maybe nobody even follows laws. Nobody knows what the consequences are of actions. Fear of death. We learn fear of death eventually. It takes a while. Most children, as in the Garden of Eden, are immortal. They don't understand the consequences of their acts or fear. I remember we were in a situation about 15 years ago in this congregation where a young woman with two small children was dying. And I went, as I do, to consult a child psychiatrist to see how best to deal with this family. And the child psychiatrist, see, I don't really act like I know everything. I go out and use resources. And I asked the child psychiatrist what to do. And he said, well, do you know what age children understand death? And I said, well, I know your answer is 7. My answer is we never do. It's always a mystery. But at some point, we do understand that the dangers can kind of be mortal, whatever that means. And we really don't agree psychologically on what that means. Fear, to me, is in a sense like the 7 deadly sins. The 7 deadly sins are all sins when they are at their extremes. Gluttony is a deadly sin, but appetite is usually a pleasure. Lust is a deadly sin. But attraction, the erotic, not so much. That's a good thing. Anger, rage is a deadly sin. But being annoyed at injustice is not a sin. It's a virtue. Sloth, being absolutely depressed and unable to move, is a sin because it removes us from the world. But resting in order to refresh ourselves is not. My thesis today is that fear is very much like, and I didn't do all the deadly sins for those of you who are counting, is very much like the traditional deadly sins, and that is fear can be very difficult and very blocking of our humanity and our ability to engage with life. But the absence of fear is a really terrible idea. If you're not afraid of some things, you're in a kind of denial that is destructive and dangerous. The issue is, how do we achieve balance? All of us who were in junior high school and paying attention, so we've got all of us who were in junior high school, paying attention is the other issue, know that we have this, what used to be called adrenaline, that's now called epinephrine, and it, when we are challenged and frightened, provokes the fight or flight reflex. You're challenging me. I see a grizzly bear. I'm going to fight it. Not such a good choice. I'm going to run from it. Maybe a good choice. The reflex does not say anything about rolling up into a ball and being batted around. But fight or flight is incomplete because there's a third one. We have fight, flight, and freeze. When we are faced with fears, legitimate fears as well as illegitimate fears, there is a sense of panic and running away from it. There's a sense of, well, I guess I better engage it and fight it because there are no options, or I guess I'll be a deer in the headlight and just freeze here and hope that nobody notices and it goes away. So the question becomes, not are we afraid? There are things to be afraid of. The question becomes, how do we act? How do we deal beyond the reflex of fight, flight, or freeze to make a reasoned path that says, this is how I'm going to engage this challenge to my life, to my society, to my world? And that's hard, because you've got all of that adrenaline, epinephrine, norepinephrine coursing through your veins, telling you, turn your brain off, folks, and follow either the crowd or your instincts. That's usually a bad idea, to follow the crowd or just the hormonal instincts. It's usually a better idea to step back, evaluate the fear. Now I will admit to you, this is hard when you're standing in front of a bear. There aren't all circumstances when you can do this, but there are many. Our society is driven by fear because we are amenable to it. We are manipulated by fear by marketers. Marketers who tell us, Jim, you've got gray hair. If you used some product, people would like you much more, and your entire life could be changed. If you would just do your nails a little bit differently, things would be different. If you use the right toothpaste, people are going to love you. If you have any natural functions or sense or... stop it! People don't want any of that natural stuff unless they're marketing a natural product to get rid of a natural human secretion. We are just told that by ourselves we're just not good enough. So unless you've got hold of all of the products that can change your hair and your look and your size and your skin and present you as somebody who is younger and more vital and more this and more that and really nothing like a real human being, you're just not going to be good enough. And the fear of rejection, the fear of not being okay and accepted, is behind much of the marketing that goes on in our society. And the thing is, if you read the papers, if you read the first three pages of the New York Times or the ads in the New Yorker, you find all of these silly things that we think are important in disguising the truth of who we are. And we get motivated by that fear of not being right, not being accepted. The marketers use it cynically and horribly. Politicians use it cynically and horribly. They make you very afraid of the other party, whatever the other party is. That other party that doesn't really love America, doesn't really love the Constitution. Those people of a different religion, a different race, a different ethnicity, a different birthplace, who are here to take from you. Be afraid, be very afraid, because if the demographics continue the way they've been going, there won't be any more of us left. They're all here to take all of our good jobs, mowing lawns and raising children and trying to have lives. It's done often cynically. It's not that there are not real problems. It's not that we don't have to wrestle with social issues. It is that we use fear and make the other something less than we are. That fear of the other. Oh my goodness, there are so many signs down in Little Korea that are in Korean. There are so many signs in Little Thailand that are in, I assume Thai, but I can't really tell you that for sure, that are in Thai. There's so many in Little India that are in one of the Hindi dialects. So, what? People present these as fearful trends that, if you extrapolate them, are going to lead to everybody who's not them being wiped out. Extrapolation is how people sell fear. Most of you have gotten the email about how there's not going to be a white Christian in Europe because that population is going to disappear in 20 years. That's nonsense, and that's the good part of it. It's only nonsense. The bad part of it, the worst part of it, is it's just completely untrue. Because all of these trends are predicated on it'll go up forever. I'm taking a picture of it. It's moving up. It'll go up forever. That's not how demographics works. It's not how society works. It's not how our society is working racially as we integrate more and more and we mix and match and mate. But the fear card, we know in politics as it's coming up this season, the fear card is being played all over the United States, particularly in border areas, and there are legitimate concerns. But when politicians try to make us afraid, they try to turn our brains off. They try to turn our reason off and make us join a mob. Gustav Le Bon, the arguably one of the founders of sociology, talked about how a mob is always not only less than the sum of the IQs in the mob, but its average is less than the average of the sum of the IQs in the mob. We surrender our will, our choice, our identity when we get swept up in a tide of fear. Fear them. Those communists, those fascists, those whatever group you want to do. And we're amenable to this because it's a natural part of us. We like fear. Anybody go to horror movies? Anybody remember seeing the original version of Psycho? Back then it was adrenaline. The adrenaline charge in a horror movie is something we respond to, the frisson of quivering a little bit and knowing that it's safe. I like those little rides at amusement parks when I used to take the kids and now take the grandkids, where you get in and it moves around and you've got all of those, the external that's making you feel like you're in a balloon and a rocket on a roller coaster. And for somebody with 3 back surgeries, I'm not getting in a balloon, a rocket, or a roller coaster. But this thing I can do, and I can be plausibly afraid. We have other people who are counterphobic, who say, you know, I want to jump out of an airplane with a parachute. I want to jump out of an airplane and just have that adrenaline rush of that fear. We are attracted to it. And so it's usually a pretty good idea not simply to have some preacher get up and say fear is bad. Fear is part of what we are. It keeps us alive. If we had not had any fear at all, very few of us would have gotten out of our teens. It is chastening. Now, I will confess to you something. I'm working on a book on fear. I'm writing a book on fear, not simply reading it, called Scared Witless. And I wrote my chapter outlines, and I sent them off, and somebody wrote back, well, you've talked about politics, you've talked about biology, you've talked about marketing, But you seem to have left something out. I didn't have a chapter on religion. Now, isn't that an interesting little piece of Freudian denial? Yeah. Something I actually know something about, and I had blocked it. Religion is tied up in fear. You're going to hell. It's motivated often by, number one, some of the social issues, which is, if you misbehave, you're gone. Number two, if you don't follow the rules, not only are things going to look bad tomorrow, but they're going to look bad for eternity. You will be separated from the presence of God. And, even more important, you won't be able to spend an infinite amount of time listening to harp music. Now, how many of you on your iPods have a playlist consisting of harp music? Anyone? And truthfully, I honestly do. I'm sorry. I actually do. But in eternity, harp music without Michael Feinstein? Come on. Be reasonable about this. Religion uses fear of separation and the ultimate extinction as one of the deep motivators. Fear gets used in every part of our society. Now, the message is not forget about fear, because there are certain things, if you're doing them and you're not afraid, I'm sorry, you're an idiot. There are certain politics, if you're looking at it and it doesn't trouble you, you're in denial. But the issue becomes when we are afraid, not if we are afraid, what do we do? And can we stop and examine? For example, let's go back to you're going to hell, Judy. I mean, I'm just using Judy as an example. I could use anyone, but you just came from Mount Diablo, and I don't. Well, Mount Diablo. You. Only a Unitarian church would put the devil in the name of the congregation. And I think that was Aaron Gilmartin's work, not Dave Salmon's.
I have reservations.
You have reservations? He has reservations, not about hell, in hell. So, you know what they say, it's heaven for climate, hell for society. Diablo Church is almost as much fun as my relatives in Corpus Christi who belong to a synagogue, Beth Shalom to Corpus Christi. You know, I just... I just kind of like these things, how they work. But it's interesting. The Western idea of hell, of hellfire and brimstone, came from the Greeks. And what does hell smell like? Sulfur. They were from the sulfur mines. They're images of, let's call it, unpleasantness. And our paradise comes from the Persian word pardesa, meaning a pleasure garden. And that's, again, a metaphor. Western religion and Eastern religion in general have two very important distinctions. Western religion understands there are things that we cannot say, that our words cannot express, and we try to do it anyway. Eastern religion says there are things our words can't express, so sit, contemplate, meditate, walking Zen, sit at the feet of a guru, get a head slap upside the head. But once you've had the experience, you still can't put it into words. We both know they can't be put into words, but we try. They say, come on. The other is on extinction. The ultimate Western fear is we close our eyes and nothing happens. It is a dreamless sleep, as Hamlet noted. Socrates noted. Hamlet said, what dreams may come. Eastern is, what do I have to do to get out of here? If I'm really good, I'll get nothing. I'll get nothingness. I'll be released from the wheel of life, from being reincarnated again and again and again, and will find ultimate peace in the plenum, in the sea of existence, not necessarily as ego or memory, but as the part of an energy of the cosmos. Very different views. And that's why the reading about fear is, the question is not, are we going to be afraid? The question is, what happens? Do we go with the flow? Do we go with the mob? Do we run away? Do we run towards with bayonets fixed? Or do we freeze in the headlights and pretend that we're invisible and it will just pass? Or do we take those natural feelings that are appropriate and say, okay, what can I choose that will mate my values with my goals, with my possibilities? How can I respond to the invitation that fear offers me? If I'm afraid of a political candidate, I guess I can yell and scream and write editorials. That might be good. Or I might be able to get to work. If I'm afraid of what's happening in the environment, I can go, oh, I'm afraid, I'm afraid, I'm afraid. It might already be too late. Why do anything? And there are groups who are well motivated who are saying the environment's critical, but it could already be too late. Why bother? All of those are bad uses of the fear that draws our attention. Don't panic. The problem is, and panic again is flight, fight, and freezing. Don't panic is do something. Information that's commensurate with possibilities. Not certainties, but possibilities. The Cassandras, the prophets of doom, whether they are right or wrong, are never listened to. That is the wisdom of the ancient ages, and it's the wisdom of today. If you are thumping and screaming that it's over and you better just resign and the sky is falling and it's too late and the forces of capitalism or the rapacious forces of industry or the water's too dirty and the genome's too corrupted and you're just better lay down and die, that's not a productive use of the information. We take the words of the Cassandras, the prophets of doom, and say, what steps can we take to make doom not a certainty? It may still be a possibility, but not a certainty. Those who give up, let others write the future. Those who engage with passion and with values have an opportunity, not a certainty, but an opportunity of influencing the outcome. We are so bad actuarially at dealing with what our powers are that we should throw out the actuarial tables. Look, for 30 years I didn't get on an airplane because I had a fear of flying. Well, no, I actually had a fear of falling. The flying wasn't the problem. The falling out of the sky in a tube of aluminum at 35,000 feet gave me pause. On the other hand, it was completely irrational. Understandable, because if you think about 35,000 feet in a tube of aluminum, you know, it should give you at least some pause, but shouldn't freeze you or paralyze you. On the other hand, I was in a cab from New York to the airport. I was much more vulnerable in the cab than I would have been in the airplane. We don't do the actuarial tables of where the dangers are very well. And that's why when challenged by the real information and the real fears, it's good not to freeze, but to stop, to listen, to evaluate the information and ask the question, okay, what can I do? What can I do, not that will messianically change everything, but can be a part of what the answer is. And it's not a question of evaluating the odds out there. It's a question of evaluating the energy and the values in here. If Rosa Parks had evaluated the odds, she would have gone to the back of the bus, because there's no way that sitting down would have been the feather that broke the camel's back. If all of the great instruments of social change had done the odds, they would have stood in bed, as Damon Runyon said. It is when we do the right thing, not with the guarantee of succeeding, but with the guarantee of acting with moral authenticity, that we can turn the fear into positive action that creates hope. And that's our job. It is not to deny the fear, not to be drowned by the fear, but to find that middle place, as in the middle place between the deadly sins, and find that place that offers us hope, and not certainty, but possibility. And that, for me, is good enough.